Radio EcoShock.
Chances are you are not living on an ideal homestead of 20 acres, ready to feed yourself and your family come what may. But what if you're on a normal city lot and maybe even in a northern climate? What can you do? It turns out quite a bit. We're going to visit with Jonathan Bates, with fellow permaculturist Eric Toinsmeyer. Jonathan has turned his 1/10 of an acre yard in Holyoke, Massachusetts, into what they call Paradise Lot. That's the title of Eric's best-selling homestead book, telling you what works and what doesn't. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for calling.
How did it start, and what did you start with?
Well, good question. Depends on how far back you want to go. But I've been kind of involved with environmental activism and interested in kind of green and ecological movements for probably over 20 years at this point. In the last 10 years or so, I've kind of focused my attention on the home economic end of things and community activism. And particularly, I like to do a lot of my work through what's called permaculture. In the last 13 years, Eric and I have been gardening together. And the last 10 years, he and I and our two families have been gardening with permaculture techniques in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
And what was the yard like when you first got there? Was it all set up as a garden?
No, not at all. You know, many of your listeners out there might have an image of a typical urban street where, 100-year-old houses sit 15 feet apart or so, and on a very small acreage, in this case, 1/10 of an acre. And when we got here, the house that was previously here had burned down. So it was an empty lot for many years, and the builder decided to build a smaller duplex. So the lot that we arrived to and saw was pretty denuded. It was covered in weeds, no trees, and most of the topsoil was either polluted or scraped off and replaced, limited material. In case of the old house, part of the yard actually was filled in with asphalt and concrete. We were really working on a landscape that was pretty poor.
Why did you decide to go with permaculture instead of the traditional row gardens found in most backyards?
Well, both mine and Eric's interest in permaculture comes from a place of holistic thinking. And even though we both support and have worked on and with organic farmers for many years and the importance of eating healthy food and healthy vegetables, we felt like have a more long-term stay and improvement in the system, perennial systems, perennial plants are the best way to go. That is, it's a lower maintenance, so there's no tillage or very little tillage. You're investing in the long-term, so you're planting with the idea that over time the yield will increase because the trees and shrubs and herbs continue to grow and get bigger each year, or at least we'll have a larger crop later on. Rather than having to spend money every year to buy seeds and the time and effort it takes to grow them out and then tillage every year, or depending on having to save your own seeds, those kinds of things. And then, you know, irrigation is different and those kinds of things. So going into it, we felt like that we had this opportunity to experiment with using permaculture techniques and edible forest gardening in particular to show that we could grow at least enough fruits and greens for our families, enough to eat every day through the growing season with lower maintenance and more diversity and more beauty, actually, than you would get if you just did some row gardening.
And it is beautiful. As it happens, I've seen a video tour of your yard with permaculture promoter Jeff Lawton, and I'll post a link to that in my show blog for listeners. Your place looks fantastic. It's stacked with greenery and food. How long did it take to get an integrated food forest going in your urban yard?
That's usually one of the hardest things for people to wrap their brains around. It's not an immediate return. It's a wait-and-see perspective. So we like to think of it as a, kind of a phase of a process, and we kind of have termed it sleep, creep, reap, and then leap. So in the book, we talk about how the perennial system is you can produce some products and foods in the early stages, but you're really kind of, it's a short-term investment for a long-term gain. And so we spread the budgeting out over the first 3 to 5 years, and then now in the 10th year, we're really reaping and things are leaping like crazy. We feel like we're probably getting close to 80% of our fruit and fresh greens in terms of feeding the families during the growing season. And Eric likes to joke that until our greenhouse got crushed by a tree a couple of years ago in a winter storm, it was 10 years before he had to ever go to the supermarket during the winter to get greens. So we've had some successes here, and we feel like a little bit of wait and see is a good strategy with this kind of design process.
I was surprised to see giant banana plants growing in New England. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That's kind of a fun thing we've been doing since the first day. It's a combination of kind of putting a front to our project that shows the neighborhood that we want to show some beauty about what we're doing and kind of an interest. It also is culturally appropriate, where there is a Puerto Rican heritage families in the neighborhood, and we grow the banana trees not for fruit, but to show that you can grow the leaves of bananas to use as pasteles, which is like a tamale that Puerto Rican folks cook and eat, a traditional food. And so a combination of beauty, interest, and actual use with them. And it's just nice, you know, in the summer, we can look out our window to the porch and see the bananas blowing in the wind, and it kind of makes us think we're in the tropics.
And I'm guessing you're not growing much during this cold snap they're calling the Arctic Vortex. Will your plants survive this punishing cold? And can you give us any tips for protecting things in a northern climate?
Sure. I could even start with the bananas. They're supposed to be hardy to a growing zone 6, which is about negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit as the coldest temperature, a minimum temperature. So in the last 10 years, we've only had one of the clumps of the bananas die, and that's with very little protection, maybe some mulch on top. It'll be interesting to see this year. It has been very cold for us, for some of our plants. One strategy, though, is there's various reasons why we grow the plants we do, but in terms of hardiness, we like to look for plants that either we know are hardy to really cold temperatures or are native, so they're already adapted to these conditions. Or we, in a lot of cases, will experiment with things outside our zone and, you know, maybe zone 6 or even zone 7, just to really prove to ourselves and the networks, the botanical networks that we're a part of, that, you know, it depends on the microclimate you're growing, and it depends on where you actually are in those growing zones. And we can really push this a little bit, I think. We don't have to grow plants and keep them in what the books tell us, because plants don't read books.
Jonathan Bates, one development of your story really pleased me. You found several ways to make a living as you practice permaculture. People put down this idea, well, you shouldn't be commercial, but people have to make a living. So tell us how Food Forest Farm Permaculture Nursery grew out of your project.
Sure. It kind of grew organically, so to speak. I didn't really grow up and get into my careers thinking I was going to be a nurseryman. But really, what one thing is nice about the way we do things here now, and we try to really live our lives in a way that meets some of the permaculture ethics and principles, is a lot of times if you plan and design well and have good thinking, the process as you go along will show you things you wouldn't have necessarily seen. Like, for example, when we did the design for the garden, the permaculture design process, really the landscape helps us design the garden. We don't try to impose our beliefs or thinking so much other than our goals. We do the same thing for our life now, too. And what happened, we've noticed in the beginning days of the project, that by about the third or fourth year, these perennial systems started to really reproduce and had a lot of baby plants and seeds that were being produced. You know, they actually, in some cases, became a problem. They became weeds, quote unquote. And we said, okay, well, we could either get rid of them and throw them out or compost them, or maybe they're actually, this problem can be turned into a solution. And what we did was the visitors and the friends that came and visited us, people interested in our garden, we started giving them away and showing people this is what it's producing, and realized in a very short time that we could actually try to sell them for a little bit of money to help pay for our project. And as it went along, we realized we could sell them for as much as $10 a piece. People were really interested in these kind of rare and interesting and useful plants that aren't very available. So that eventually evolved to us and me realizing, after a couple of years as a hobbyist playing around with these ideas, that this could actually be a viable business. And right now, I'd say maybe about a third of the income for our family depends on this business, and we're actually moving toward possibly more than half or all of our income coming from not only the nursery, but we do also educational services like speaking events and presentations and tours and consultations as part of the business.
Really, you're spreading the seeds of your own ideas to other people's land and gardens. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. My guest is New England small-scale grower and permaculturalist Jonathan Bates. Do you have any tips for us about labor-saving techniques or tools that you discovered along the way?
Sure. Other than doing a good design, which I think is a big part of it, and a lot of experimentation and learning what doesn't work and what works, actual physical tools, one that has become important to us that more and more people are finding out about is the broad fork. There's various models out there, but what we tend to use it for now is we do have a few annual beds, and sometimes I joke is that we grew carrots and beets. We have the vegetables we grew before broad fork and the vegetables we grew after broad fork, and it's an amazing difference. Before broad fork, our carrots would and beets would, you know, split and have multiple bottoms and not grow very well because of hitting the hard pan. Now that we have the broad fork and we loosen the soil and aerate it down as much as 13 inches, we're growing the best carrots we've ever grown. So aeration with tools like a broad fork is really important, we found. And even if you're going to do a perennial permanent system like we've done, it's important to use tools like that to aerate the soil before you even lay down your mulch or your compost to get things set. That's one tool, the broad fork. I think another tool that's been really helpful is the hori hori, which is, it's a hand tool, sort of like a cross between a shovel and a knife. It's very strong, it's solid steel, and I use it a lot for digging out weeds and also transplanting. Pruners are very important, hand pruners. Felco makes some really great tools for pruning fruit trees and shrubs, and I also use it to propagate a lot for my nursery. And maybe the last physical tool that we use that I really, really find is probably one of my most used tools is a full flat shovel, steel shovel with a steel shank that's a complete piece of steel from the shovel to the handle. And I use a short shovel so that I can kind of stand on it and hold it while I'm pushing it with my feet. It's great. It has a cutting edge at the bottom. And because it's fully steel and really heavy duty, you can use it as a fulcrum to like pull out plants. They have strong roots. You can cut roots with them. And the company I bought from is called King of Spades. They make one of the best products. So that's kind of my little, I don't know, toolkit, literally. But there are some other tools we use that aren't physical. Like we incorporate a lot of volunteerism and help and support from the community. I think that's important. I think doing this on our own wouldn't have been possible. We use various media outlets like the internet and books and speaking engagements to get the word out. That's a really important tool for us. And more we're actually a really important tool is sharing the yield. And right now we don't, you know, other than the nursery, we're not selling food, but our workshops now we have at least two tastings that people can sign up for. And the tool here is having people taste what we grow. And it turns out it's one of the most effective ways to convince people to do this kind of work.
Right. The proof is in the mouth. Well, tell us just briefly about the Northeast Permaculture Organization.
It's mostly historically been a network. There isn't any formal organization up until recently. It's been slow to develop. There are now either meetup groups and or guilds, as they're called, throughout the Northeast and in pretty much every state, I think except for Connecticut. I think they're starting to form one there, but there isn't one. And there are these groups in Maine, there are groups in New Hampshire, in Vermont, in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island. And in some of these states, there are regional subgroups like Northern or Southern groups, Eastern or Western groups. New York is another very active state. For many years, the Northeast Permaculture Network has put on what's called the Permaculture Convergence. It's, I think, either 9 or 10 years old, and I've been involved since the beginning. And it's a state rotational conference, essentially, and every state takes on organizing the next one. The last one was in up near your way. Well, you're west, so east, and in Canada. I don't know where the next one's going to be. But if you want to find out more information, a great organization to look up is PINE, Permaculture Institute of the Northeast. And I'm not sure what the website is, but you can search that on the internet and it'll come up. And it's a great resource, and it's becoming kind of an important hub for people to find out what's happening permaculturally in the Northeast.
And there's an intriguing photo on your website of something called a Greenfield Bioshelter. What is that?
It's a new project that I've been working on with the Regenerative Design Group. They're working with me as a subcontractor. And they came to me because we also are now consulting on bioshelters because we have a really successful one in our backyard that we built 2 years ago. And the Greenfield Bioshelter is a client that has just started building it, so it's in the build phase. But the idea is it's similar in structure and function to the one that we've built. The one we built in our backyard is 2 years old. It's gone through two winters. And essentially what it does with the right design and the right built with the right materials, appropriate materials, you can get, quote unquote, a passive solar greenhouse to keep warm enough to overwinter subtropical plants without any supplemental heat other than the sun. So I don't know how many of your listeners out there have ever been in a passive solar greenhouse, but the idea is the north side's insulated, the south side is your clear side to let in the winter sun, and the sun angle is lower in the winter, so you can really gain a lot of heat if you design it right. And we also add things like water features into the system so that you're collecting the thermal mass and collecting the heat and storing it. The foundation is insulated, so the ground is also a thermal mass. We're doing things like growing citrus and avocados in Massachusetts with a system like this.
It sounds great. You and partner Eric have a book out on perennial vegetables and another one in the works, I gather, on gardening and climate. What can you tell us about those?
Sure, and let me just clarify. Eric is really the main author of our partnership is in this garden. He's written many books, including perennial vegetables. I didn't really have a hand in that other than maybe literally my hand in a picture or something, or maybe my photo or a quote. But the book that we both recently authored together called Paradise Lot, he was the main author and I was a contributor. And essentially that book is really the story of the work we do together in our garden and the work that our families help us with. In that, actually, it's a really good resource if you want to learn about both our histories as people and the work we've done here, and including a lot of the work that Eric's done over the years, including his books. So that's a really great resource if you want to learn more about what we do.
Can you give us any websites or Facebook pages where people can follow up on this?
If you want to learn more about my business, Food Forest Farm, and actually order products from there if you'd like, or just read more about what I do, you can go to foodforestfarm.com. That's a really good resource. Eric's website is perennialsolutions.org, so that's a really great resource you can check out. He also has a website, perennialvegetables.org, so you can check that one out. And the Permaculture Institute of the Northeast, if you want to search for that, that's a really great resource. And both on my website and on Eric's website, we have listings of other great resources, so I would point you to those two pages.
Our guest is Jonathan Bates. He's the owner of Food Forest Farm Nursery and a partner in changing a New England backyard into a food forest in Holyoke, Massachusetts. It was great hearing about this, Jonathan. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. You have a good day.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.